World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edward Willett, and this episode's guest, Susan Forrest. Welcome to The World Shapers, the program where I talk to science fiction and fantasy authors about their creative process. And I am myself a science fiction and fantasy author. My name is Edward Willett, as I said already once, and I am your host. And I've always enjoyed talking to other authors about their process, and I decided it would make a great podcast, and so far I think it has. Now, my own latest book is A Master of the World. This is book two in my World Shaper series from Daw Books. It's set in a vast labyrinth of shaped worlds where the shapers of those worlds live within them, sort of like authors living inside the books that they create. In book one, my main character, Shauna Keyes, discovered she was the shaper of her world. She thought it was just our world, the only world there was. And she had to flee from the adversary who's trying to take over all of the shaped worlds with the help of a companion named Carl Yatzer. He thinks that she has the power to save all of the shaped worlds from the adversary by gathering the knowledge of these worlds and taking them to the mysterious Agrair, who's at the center of the labyrinth. So in the first book, she does escape her world, obviously, or there'd be no second book. The second book, which is out now, Master of the World, is takes place in a world that was shaped by somebody with a great affinity for the works of Jules Verne. So it's a very steampunk world. I had great fun with it. There's submarines and flying machines and floating islands, all sorts of great Jules Verne-y stuff. And Shauna is alone for much of the book, having misplaced her guide at the end of the first book, so she has to navigate her way through this Jules Verne book. It's available right now in trade paperback, audiobook, and ebook. I'm working on book three in the series right now. It doesn't have a formal title, but you can get a hint of what it's going to be like by the name that I have in my head for it, which is Werewolves, Vampires, and Peasants. Oh my. So it's that kind of world. Now, there's something new for the World Shapers this week. I have formally joined the Saskatchewan Podcast Network. This is exactly as it sounds like, podcasts that are hosted by people right here in the great province of Saskatchewan. And if you're interested in checking out the Saskatchewan Podcast Network, it's at saskpodcastnetwork.com. If you have a Saskatchewan podcast, you can join, or if you're just looking for some other great podcasts, you can look them up there. And also, the Saskatchewan Podcast Network is supported by Kinexus, and that means that there'll be some ad reads in the introduction to these episodes going forward. And here's the very first time I've ever done it. The Saskatchewan Podcast Network is supported by Kinexus. Wellness, however you define it, is achievable. You don't even need to figure it all out yourself. Talk to Kinexus. They'll give you guidance, motivation, and the push you need to reach your goals. They've got you. They're your financial partner, and they know you can achieve your very best, your financial best. Prove them right. Start right at Kinexus Credit Union. There you go. A first for the World Shapers podcast, my first actual advertising. Well, that's enough for the introduction. Let's get on to this episode's guest, Susan Forrest. Susan Forrest grew up in a family of mountaineers, canoeists, and skiers, and she loves adventure. She also loves the big ideas found in science fiction and fantasy, and finds fast-paced adventure stories a great place to explore how individuals grapple with complex moral decisions. She's an award-winning fiction editor as well for Laxa Media. Her novel, Bursts of Fire, which just came out and is going to be followed by Flights of Marigolds next year, starts a new 7-book YA epic fantasy series, the Addicted to Heaven series, and we're going to be focusing on that first book, Bursts of Fire, in the podcast. She's also published more than 25 short stories, contributes to When Words Collide, which regular listeners will know I often plug as a great place to, as a great convention to go to in Calgary each summer, and has appeared at many international writing conventions. She also loves to travel and has been known to dictate novels from the back of her husband's motorcycle. And there's a great picture of you with a motorcycle on your website. So there you go. Among the markets that she's published in include Analog and Asimov's and Beneath Ceaseless Skies. And she's also edited for a number of markets, including Strangers Among Us and The Sum of Us, two anthologies from Laxa Media, both of which had a story by me in it, he said modestly, and both of which won the Pre-Aurora Award in 2017 and 2018. She served two terms as Secretary for the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America and has judged the Endeavor and Sunburst Awards and teaches creative writing in Calgary. And she's a busy lady, but she's joining us. There's just me, joining me here today on the World Shapers. And welcome, Susan.
Hello, hello, hello.
Now, we've known each other for a few years.
Yes.
Because science fiction is, science fiction conventions in Calgary, which turned into When Words Collide in a roundabout sort of way, was what first started me going over to Calgary on a yearly basis. And I think probably the first time I went, I probably met you. And that's been a long time ago now.
Probably, yes. I remember.
Well, I always like to start these by taking guests, I usually say back into the mists of time, which is becoming almost a cliche on the show, but I'm going to say it anyway because it fits. Going back into the mists of time, how did you first become interested in science fiction and fantasy, and how did you become interested in writing it? And, you know, where did you grow up and all that kind of thing?
Oh, yes. Well, I think the first books I really remember reading, like full novels, were Edgar Rice Burroughs' Tarzan series. My dad actually was a big fan, way back in the 30s, when they were super popular, and he would go to secondhand bookstores and bring them back for my older brother to read, actually. And so we didn't necessarily start with Tarzan of the Apes. We started with whatever secondhand book he could find at the store. So my brother would read them and then he would pass them on to me. So that's a huge memory as far as reading is concerned. I always thought of myself as a writer from the time I was quite small. I think I was in grade 2 and I wrote a book called Jimmy the Fish That Couldn't Swim. That's the first thing I remember writing. And when I was in grade 7, I used to, I was a very studious person, and I would, I had a big binder with all my subjects in it. And when the teacher was finished teaching, they'd usually give us some time to do some homework. So I'd sit at the back, I'd get my homework done. And then I had a novel at the back of my binder, and I would just open that up and just work away on that a little bit at a time. So that's my earliest writing that I can think of.
And did that continue as you went on through high school? And
oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I never did stop writing. That's for sure. I don't know that it's something that I pursued professionally for a long time, but I always had a book that I was working on.
Did you share it when you were a young reader? Did you share your writing? I always ask that because I think it's a valuable thing for young writers to do, is to let other people read it and get an idea if you're telling stories that other people will enjoy reading.
Only to a very small degree, maybe a very few close friends. It's kind of interesting, even today, like if I like to go skiing, and I'll be on the ski lift, and people will say, oh, well, what do you do? And I say, I'm a writer. And they say, oh, yeah, what have you published? You know, all this sort of stuff. But they say, what do you write? I say, science fiction. And it tends to stop the conversation.
Yes,
because
it does.
People don't have anything to relate to. So, yeah.
Well, and I, of course, live in Regina, Saskatchewan, as you know, but listeners may not necessarily. And our professional football team here is called the Saskatchewan Rough Riders, which are the Riders for short. So half the time, if I say I'm a writer, people will look at me funny. Aren't you a little old to be a football player? No, a writer. It's a writer. So around here, you have to be really careful how you pronounce it,
too. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So.
Well, was it science fiction and fantasy from the start, or were some of your early, well, I guess The Fish Who Couldn't Swim could be considered a fantasy.
I suppose. I really did enjoy reading horse stories. Alec Ramsey, The Black Stallion was huge, absolutely. I remember one time going to visit my cousin, though. She would read the Tarzan books, and she said, guess what? Edgar Rice Burroughs also writes science fiction. He writes John Carter of Mars. So, of course, got into that whole series. A little bit later, I was really interested in Ursula K. Le Guin, you know, the whole Earthsea series, Left Hand of Darkness, some of those books I really enjoyed reading. And I have a really strong memory of first getting involved with Tolkien. Again, it was my older brother who came up with this book, and we had one copy, and everybody in our family was reading it. So you had to look right and left to see who had the book, right? And one time he just got so mad at me. He was going out, and I knew he was going to take the book with him, and I grabbed the book, and I ran to the local school, the local junior high school that I attended, and it had a courtyard that was almost three-quarters blocked off from the street. And I had the book, and I was walking around in there and reading it. And he came along, and he just glared at me, grabbed the book, and left. He never yelled at me or anything, but I knew I was in big trouble.
So when you got on through high school and into university, did you study writing, or what did you focus on?
Actually, I've got a couple of university degrees, but they're both in education. I was a teacher for many years. I was interested in taking creative writing, but it was quite difficult because the university tended to stream people. If you were in certain fields, there were courses that you couldn't take in other fields. It was actually after I was teaching for a while that I was able to go back and take a course at the university with Aretha Van Herk. It was just an introduction to creative writing. And the way I got into it was kind of funny because it was August and I wanted to take a course in September, and I went and I got on the website and I signed up, and it looked like a great course to take. And I showed up at the first class. It was an evening course. It was on a Thursday night, and it was absolutely crammed with people. I don't know. There were like 40 people in this room, which I thought was a little odd. And the teacher, the professor, came in, and she was angry. She said, "Half of you don't belong here. We vetted the people who were going to come into this course way back in the spring, and the registrar let a whole bunch of people in, and there's only allowed to be a maximum of, I don't know, 16 people in this class. So half of you don't belong here." But then she turned around and said, "However, if you have a chapter in your bottom drawer and you send it to me in the next day, I might let somebody in." And guess what? I had a chapter in the bottom of the drawer. I didn't know anything, so I went ahead and just sent it in. And she let me in. And I think of those extra 20 people, I was the only people that got into the course. So, yeah.
So I often ask writers who have taken any sort of formal creative writing whether they ran into a pushback on the genre that they wish to write in. Were you writing something in the speculative fiction genre for that chapter that you sent in, or was it something?
Oh, yes, absolutely. It was a fantasy novel. I always thought of myself as a fantasy novelist, especially before I knew myself better. But I did write a variety of different things while I was in that class, so I was using it as an opportunity to experiment. I learned a lot in that course. I know that, well, if I can brag just a little bit, I have a daughter who got her PhD in creative writing. Yes, it certainly was her experience that writing in the fantasy and science fiction genres, she did experience that, and I have in other circumstances as well. But I think the issue for me was I knew so little at that time that I was just a sponge. I was just soaking up every possible thing that I could get. I think I wound up with a C on that course, and I really think I deserved it. I think it might even been generous. I don't know. But I continued to learn from that course for like 2 years after I took it, just because I knew so little and there was so much, and I would go back and I would revisit in my mind and experiment and try new things. So it was a really good course for me.
Well, as I've mentioned previous on the podcast, my degree was in journalism, so I only took one creative writing course in university, and the name of our textbook was actually three genres, and I thought, oh, wow, you know, what is that, like romance, mystery, and science fiction? But no, it was plays, short stories, and poetry is what the textbook meant. And no, I don't recall what I wrote for fiction for that, it must have been science fiction or fantasy because that's all I wrote.
That's right, right, yeah.
But the one thing I got the highest praise on from the teacher was actually a piece of poetry, which really startled me.
Whoa, whoa.
But yeah, you know, just the fact that you're writing in, because I'd never thought of, you know, writing poetry, but I had to for the course. And just the, those classes and things like that do expose you to different ideas and different writing. Even if they don't like what you would like to write, you can often learn things from them, I think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So when did you start seriously pursuing publication?
Well, way back, actually, a number of years ago, although I didn't belong to any writers' groups, I would, you know, worry away at my little project. I would work during the day and come home and write at night. And I belonged to the Writers Guild of Alberta, but it was, I mean, the result of that was simply I got a magazine once every 3 months or something like that. But I would look at the back and there would be markets listed. And this particular time I was looking, Gage Educational Publishing was looking for novels. So I had a novel. So I sent it off. And that was my first published book. It's something that I don't tend to talk about very much because I'm really amazed. When I look back at that work right now and think, they published that? Really? it was really a two-edged sword because on the one hand, I now had a published book. So that put me into a whole other category for all kinds of things. Because it was a young adult book, I've been working with the Young Writers Conference for a number of years here in Calgary. It meant that I could apply for grants. It meant that I could do all kinds of things because I had a book. The flip side of it is, it's a terrible book. You know how they say editors do you a great favor mm-hmm. when they don't buy your book? Book that isn't ready? Yeah, no, that's a really true thing. So on the one hand, I'm really glad I got it published. On the other hand, I'm kind of embarrassed by it.
But that was your first one.
That was the first one.
When did the second publication come around? And was it short fiction? Or because you started with short fiction before you went back to novels, didn't you?
Yes, absolutely. Well, a number of things came together. For one thing, I did start to meet other writers. I belonged to writers' groups. We actually met face-to-face and critiqued each other's work. I took a number of workshops. So my writing was really growing. And one of the things that I decided to do was to try short fiction. As I said, I always thought of myself. My image of myself was as a fantasy novelist. So I didn't think I could write short fiction. I didn't think I could write science fiction. You know, all these limitations that I placed on myself. But one of the things I discovered was that I was spending a lot of time at the beginning of long works. And I was not learning, I guess, to write a full arc. And I thought, let's work away with short stories and try to write a full arc. And I would put them on the table for my critiquers and they would say, yep, that's chapter one of another novel, you know. So definitely I had quite a learning curve as far as writing short stories was concerned. But I pursued and I persisted. And again, your mileage may vary. And I know other people have found this does not necessarily work for them. But maybe it was because I just happened to belong to a very knowledgeable and supportive writers group, which I'll give them a little plug. It's the Imaginative Fiction Writers Association of Calgary. Very large group. As long as you're serious about writing, you can join it. You don't have to be published. So it goes from rank beginners right up to very well published writers. Robert J. Sawyer is an honorary member. So it was a really good place to learn a lot. And one of the things I learned was when an editor is new to a publication or moves up within a publication to take a stronger editorial role, they may be trying to develop their own stable of authors. And I had a short story that I wanted to submit just about the time that Sheila Williams became editor for Asimov's magazine. She didn't take the first story or even the second story that I submitted to her, but she did take the third story that I submitted to her. And so that was my burst into what I would call really much more professional writing.
You know, that's one of the top markets in the field when it comes to short fiction, for sure, that one, and analog.
I know. So
fantasy and science fiction used to be the big three. I mean, there's a lot more stuff out there now. But
yeah, I've never got into FNSF, but my story about getting into analog was kind of interesting. So I mentioned that I went to a number of workshops, and one of them was the pro who ran it was Mike Resnick. And oh, he was really tough on everybody around the table. One of the women, unfortunately, well, she did something that she probably shouldn't have done. She took out an old trunk piece she hadn't even looked at and put it on the table. And he kind of gave her a good tongue lashing. He said, "You have 12 people around this table who have spent time and energy on your work, and you didn't care enough to give us your best." Mm. You know, so he was pretty tough on us. But one of the things I remember was the absolute look of horror on his face when he looked around the table and he said, and this is probably a direct quote, I remember it so well, "You all want to be professional writers and you don't go to Worldcon?" You know, so one of the things that I did start doing was going to international conventions, and you know, when you have friends like Robert J. Sawyer, who was able to make a few introductions, it really helped. So I met Stan from Analog. And I think making that connection maybe made a bit of a difference. But the other thing, too, was just, you know, talking to other writers. People would say, if you want to get into analog, try something short and funny. So I had sent something in that he called Bleak. And then I sent in another one that was full of puns, and he really liked it. He said he laughed out loud, but it wasn't a piece he thought that his readers would really think of as science fiction. And again, it was the third one that I sent in. But I'll tell you a little story. I also go on a fairly regular basis to the Rainforest Writers Retreat in Northwest Washington State. And I happened to be there one time and just in a position to overhear the conversation between two editors. And one of them was saying to the other, "Do you know such and such a writer? Has she submitted to your magazine?" And the other one said, yeah, she's pretty good. "Have you published anything by her?" No, not yet." "Well, have you heard anything about her recently?" "Oh, I haven't heard anything recent. I wonder if she stopped one story short of a sale." And, you know, it just really struck me that people in the business do know one another and are aware, and in some ways, I think, are encouraging new writers. I mean, they have to have the best of the best for their publications, but that they're aware and are encouraging. At least that's been my experience anyway.
So you would recommend to new writers that they make an effort to get to these conventions and things like that, it sounds like?
Yes. I think
it's a lot of money to go to an international convention.
Oh, it certainly is. And I certainly have to watch which ones I'm able to go to. But again, Rob Sawyer said something that kind of stuck with me a number of years ago. He said, "Always put your stories into the top markets first. If it gets rejected from there, there are the mid-tier markets and so forth that you can still try." And his reasoning for this was, he said, in your mind, you need to think of yourself as at that level, right? If you think of yourself at that level, then you will write to that level and you will be at that level, which kind of makes sense. So I think the same thing with going to the conventions. by the fact that you attend, you can learn a lot, for one thing. You can also meet people, which is helpful. But also, you see yourself at that level. I am a professional. This is what I do.
Well, certainly since those early sales, you've racked up a considerable number of short fiction sales. But now we're going to talk about your novel, which is starting a pretty ambitious project, a 7-volume epic fantasy series.
Yes.
So this still goes back to the short fiction as well. I mean, I know it's a cliche and these sorts of things. You ask, where do you get your ideas? But it is a valid question. I know ideas are everywhere, but at the same time, we all have little things that tend to spark them in us and spark story ideas. So first of all, before we do that, let's get a brief synopsis of Bursts of Fire, the first book, without spoilers, because I'm only about halfway through it.
Okay. Bursts of Fire is the first book, and it's a story of three sisters. Meg is the eldest. She's 17, and she's essentially the protagonist, but the other two sisters are very important as well. They are magic wielders, but they are very highly placed. They're like princesses. They've grown up in a castle with all of the benefits of that and very little life experience. Their mother is the magic wielder for the king who has the second most powerful prayer stone in this fantasy world. Their mother sees a glimpse of the future, and she sees that war is coming. She wants to save her daughters. She also wants to save this magical prayer stone, and she wants to save the balance of the world that is quite healthy at this point. So yes, their castle is attacked right away in chapter one. And the mother, because she has this bit of premonition, she is able to help her daughters flee. And so the three daughters flee with their nurse, who is killed almost immediately. And the three sisters are in this world as refugees alone. You were going to say something.
I was just going to say I knew the nurse was doomed because you have to get your young protagonists on their own as quickly as possible.
Oh, yeah, exactly. So they meet, of course, now when something huge like this happens in a world, things don't stay static. You have people who are going to rise up and say, hey, this is wrong. We want to do something about it. And so a very nascent rebel group starts to form, and the sisters get involved with that. So that's how the story begins.
Now, now I can go back to the question. What was the seed for this story? Where did that seed come from for you? And is it typical of the way that you come up with the story ideas?
You know, it's been a very interesting process to work on this series because I think I heard somebody say this very recently, but I think it's quite true that fantasy in particular, I think it tends to take itself very seriously. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the writing that I had been doing in the fantasy genre, I think really I was feeling, oh, this is dark and getting darker. And I have a very strong memory. I can't place the memory in time, but a very strong memory of camping and being in a tent in the morning, waking up, you know, that's so beautiful. It was warm in the tent. The sun was shining through and just thinking, oh my goodness, what I really want to do is I want to write a heist romp. I want to do something light, something just, you know, with maybe even some comic moments and what have you. And that is actually where the idea came from. But I think I had an image of a young female thief climbing up the outside of a castle tower was kind of the image that this whole thing sprang from. And it does happen later in the series, is still there. But when I was a teacher, one of the experiences that I was very fortunate to have was to take a course that was called mini counseling. It was like a 3-day course in counseling because teachers do have to, you know, counsel students all the time. And one of the gems that came out of that was, as a counselor, it's not necessary to talk to a client and say, you know, what is your deepest, darkest secret that you fear? You can start anywhere, because whatever is bothering somebody is going to come out in its own good time. And I think that is also true in the writing process, that the themes and the ideas that you yourself are wrestling with may be very you're not aware of them. They're in your subconscious, but they're going to come out in your themes and in your writing anyway. And so, yeah, I wanted to write a really lighthearted heist romp, but no.
I can't say that's the way it's coming out.
No. The book gets into a whole lot of deeper issues, because that's what's bubbling up out of my subconscious.
So is that sort of seeing an image? Is that a fairly typical way for you to latch onto a story idea? Just something in your mind that says, oh, that would be cool.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot of visualization, for sure, that happens in the early stages of my writing. Yeah, absolutely.
So as you begin to develop this, what does there's quite a bit of a fairly complicated magical thing going on here.
Yes.
And something I don't believe I've read anything quite like it before. So was there a lot of world building before you even begin plotting, or how did all that planning and synopsizing work for you?
Yeah, well, I meet a lot of people who are pantsers, and I understand that there's some great advantages to writing by the seat of your pants. A friend of mine once said, you know, when I'm writing by the seat of my pants, I can surprise myself. And if I can surprise myself, I can surprise the reader. And, you know, surprise is a wonderful thing to be able to have in your stories, for sure. But I have never been a pantser. I have always plotted my stories right from the very beginning. However, my process is a bit more complex than that, because I do tend to go back and forth in the initial stages between just writing scenes and planning, and then writing some more scenes and planning. And I think it's because I really don't know enough about my world, and I don't know enough about my characters until I see them in action. So I have to write some chapters or some scenes before I can really get deep into the planning. On the other hand, I don't get too deep into the book before I do create a complete of quite a detailed outline.
And do you follow that outline as you write, or does it wander off occasionally?
I tend to follow it fairly closely in the broad strokes. Having said that, yeah, you know what? If your story is telling you need to do something, you need to listen to that, because that's where the surprise comes from. I remember one time very clearly writing along, and I had two con men. This is in the same series. It's a little later on. And one of them said, all we need is a miracle. And I thought, yeah, that's perfect. And then I thought, okay, now I have to come up with a miracle. But, you know, as a writer, you have time. Because if you are a performing artist, as you know, because you're a performing artist, when you're on stage doing something, whatever comes out of your mouth, well, it's out of your mouth, you know, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, right? As a writer, we do have that to a degree. I mean, eventually there are deadlines, but to a degree, we have the opportunity to go back and rewrite. And if you need a miracle, you can do some research and you can come up with a miracle.
Well, how did you come up with the idea for this particular magic system? And maybe you should explain a little bit about what the magic is like in this book.
I'm really enjoying working with this magic system, because it's giving me so many tools to do so much in the books that I really enjoy. For your listeners, I'm sure they're quite aware that magic systems always have to have a cost. And so it's important that the magic system does not allow your magic wielder to just do anything in the world. There have to be limitations. The magic is based on the manipulation of time. So the people who have this ability can hold an object still in time, so it doesn't move as the time stream flows around it, or they can take it back in time, or they can take it forward in time. But usually just a very small object, maybe, I don't know, something the size of a pea is about all they can do. So they can't just take the entire world and stop it in time. So let me just give an example, which is right away in the early part of the book. These three girls are trying to escape the city. The gate is locked. They are able to find a time when that lock was open, and then they walk through the gate. Mm. Yeah. So it works in these very small ways. The cost of the magic is that once you have used magic, you have disturbed the time stream, and that therefore you live bits and pieces of your own life out of order. And there's no way of knowing how that's going to happen. It's quite random. You may suddenly find yourself at a time in your past, but only for a few seconds. Or you may find yourself at a time in your future, but again, only for a few seconds. And that is really important because, take for instance, the fact that three girls' mother knows something bad is going to happen, but she doesn't know what, she doesn't know when. So she's preparing for her girls to get out of the city, but the bad thing happens before the preparations are complete because she doesn't know when. So it allows for a little bit more adventure, a little bit more, surprise. One of the things that you sometimes find in fantasy novels that I find quite irritating is the prophecy. Prophecies are very problematic. Either the prophecy is right, in which case it's kind of boring because you got the prophecy and then you get the adventure and they're the same, so there's no surprise. Or the prophecy is wrong, in which case it wasn't a very good prophecy. So people tend to write prophecies in very cryptic language that could be interpreted in a whole lot of different ways, which in my mind, I just find it kind of irritating.
Right. It's like if you're a prophet, why can't you be clear?
Yeah, exactly. So the advantage to this is we can see bits and pieces of the future, just not enough to tell what the whole story is. So you can get that foreshadowing. You can get the tool to use to help you to a degree, but without giving away the whole story.
So once you actually start writing, what does your writing process look like? Do you write with, you know, longhand on a parchment out under the stars?
Does anybody really? maybe some people do. No, I'm very much, I think through my fingers. In fact, sometimes, I might be helping somebody with something else and I'll say, just let me write this. And then I'll know what I want to say, and then I tell it. I can really think through my fingers on the keyboard. I do tend to be I've planned it. I'm going to start with scene one, chapter one, and work my way through. But recently, I have been experimenting a little bit more with quilting. So you've heard of writing by the seat of your pants, or pantsing, planning, and then quilting is where you write a scene or a chapter, and it could fit anywhere in the book, or it may not be in the book at all. And then you string your quilted scenes together with the other scenes that you require. And I have been experimenting with that a little bit for a couple of reasons. One is I love to ride on the back of my husband's motorcycle, and especially on the windy, twisty roads, it's like riding a roller coaster. It's tons of fun. But, not all riding on the motorcycle is hills and curves. Some of it is straight, boring highway for hours at a stretch. And we don't have the means to talk to each other in our helmets. So what I do is I get a tape recorder, and I've got a lovely little tiny microphone that I can stuff inside my helmet. And of course, I have to stuff a lot of padding in there so I don't get any road noise. And I can write, usually about four scenes in a day of motorcycle riding, which is about 4,000 words. And you know what? If you go on a 10-day motorcycle trip, you can get a chunk of your book done that way.
Well, that, you're the first person I've talked to that writes on the back of a motorcycle. So, but, that's a new one.
So what I do is I know what's in the scene because I made the plan. I write a little point form note that maybe has three or four things that I want to occur in this scene. And then I dictate the scene. When I get, you know, if we stay in a hotel, usually by the end of the day, my husband's really tired because he did all the work. So he'll have a nap, and then I can get out the tape recorder and I transcribe onto my iPad. You have to wear very small equipment on a motorcycle. And then I usually just transcribe, and I need to do it right away because sometimes, you know, with the road noise, it's hard to get some of the words.
I was going to ask you about that, yeah.
And you, there's no way I would ever try to use Dragon on a motorcycle because I would get complete gobbledygook. So I transcribe it right away, maybe do a little bit of editing at that point. But because of this method, I need to be very clear in my mind about the scene that I'm doing. So I pick, like, the best scenes. I pick the most active ones or the ones with the greatest interpersonal conflict or the ones that are clearest in my mind, and which means that the ones that are still a bit fuzzy in my head, those are the ones that I really need to have that focus and concentration to do my initial drafts.
Well, once you've got this all assembled and you have your first or draft, what does your revision process look like? Do you go back to the very beginning and rewrite the whole thing, or by the time you get to the end, have you sort of rewritten as you go along and it's pretty much done?
Lots of times there are going to be problems somewhere in the book, usually multiple places in the book. So my first go-to is going to probably just be a complete read-through to say, how is this whole thing hanging together? And, you know, the low-hanging fruit, capturing those things that are really obvious. I do a number of edits. I'm not... I think I do actually a fairly clean first draft, but... like something that I'm dictating, for instance, is not going to be a very clean first draft. It's going to be have all kinds of problems with it. So I revise, and I'm looking for story arcs. I'm looking for character arcs. I'm looking for interweaving the world building. And world building is so important because it's way more than just the physical description, right? It's the technological development, it's the social development, the attitudes of people toward everything that's going on, that you never have, I mean, this is a truism, an entire group that thinks the same way. There are going to be people who disagree within a group. So ensuring that those that layering and that complexity is in, and then, you know, finally, of course, you do have to look at the words and the sentences and the making it the best it can be.
Well, and this is where I wanted to talk about your editing career, because how did you get started editing other people, and, you know, how does your experience as an editor play into editing your own stuff?
Oh, it has been absolutely amazing. It is one of the best things that I ever could have done. I had, I'm guessing 20 years of critiquing other people's works because I belonged to a couple of three or four different critique groups at different times. So I got lots of practice with that. Between giving critiques and receiving critiques, you learn a lot, and you learn so much by critiquing other people's work. Lots of times what you do yourself, the mistakes you make yourself, you can't see them until you see them in somebody else's work. So that was, I think, a really solid basis. And then when I stopped teaching, I was actually approached by Edge Science Fiction and Fantasy Publishing to edit for them. So I edited in total three novels for them, one of which was nominated for the Pre-Aurora Award, so I was really happy about that. And then I also became a freelance editor as well. And then, when was it? I guess 4 or 5 years ago, when Laxa Media first got started, again, I was invited to edit for them, and that was a bit of a daunting experience because I remember being at World Fantasy Convention one year and sitting with a bunch of editors at a table at various stages and saying, I'm starting on this new project. The publisher has invited some really high-level authors, and it's just making me a bit nervous. And the advice I got back was, the bigger the author, the more professional and the easier they are to work with. And you know, that was absolutely true. I have to say, I can remember one particular story I edited where the author was really busy with a deadline. And so we got the story a little bit late and I went through it and I thought, oh, this is a really good story, but it's got a couple of plot holes and what have you. And I really didn't want to write the letter saying, can you fix this and this? But I did. And the author got back to me and said, I've done all the things you wanted. Have a look. I looked at it. Not only had this author done all the things I wanted, but way more. And it was an amazing story. And I felt so good about it. But the best part was I ran into that author at a convention later who said to me that he really appreciated my editing. And I thought, oh, I was thrilled.
You know, well, it's something that, and you know, I do a lot of editing too, and I find the same thing, that editing other people's stuff and mentoring other writers and all that stuff that I do feeds right back into my own writing, and I start to see things that maybe I wouldn't see if it weren't for the fact that I'm seeing it in other people's stuff too.
Oh, so absolutely.
I think it is very, very useful. Well, okay, so now you've done your revisions. You're actually an editor at Laxa Media, but presumably you're not your own editor at Laxa Media.
No. It's unfortunate that it's a little bit incestuous that way. I did start working as an editor with Laxa Media first, but I did have this novel that I was working on, and Lucas Law. For people who don't know, Laxa Media is very small, so it was Lucas Law. And he said to me, I'm interested in your novel, and can we talk about it? And we talked about it actually for, oh, at least a full year, probably closer to a year and a half, before we finally said, yeah, this novel would fit with Laxa Media. And here's something that I found really interesting. I found Lucas to be an excellent editor for my work. But one of the things he said early on that was really huge was, he said, I enjoy your story. I think it you've got something here that we can work with. But Laxa Media has its niche. It is into social causes. So the first anthology they put out, Strangers Among Us, was about mental health and mental illness. The second one, The Sum of Us, was about caregivers and caregiving. The third one was about migrations, Shades Within Us. And so he said, what is the social cause that your book is really dealing with? And it was interesting because that was not something I had thought about up until that point. But as you say, you know, what you're wrestling with in your subconscious comes out. And I just took one look at him and I said, addictions. That's exactly what it's dealing with. And as soon as he asked me that question, I knew the answer. Now, having said that, sometimes thematic threads that are nascent, that are in the book, but kind of bubbling under the surface, then you want to go back with your edit and say, okay, how am I developing this? What is it that I have to say, and how is it coming through? So, for instance, as you mentioned earlier, this is a 7-book series, and the topic of addictions is absolutely huge, which is a wonderful way that these things work together, because Bursts of Fire is dealing exactly like the title says, it's first tastes. It's a YA take on a novel. The girls are 17, 16, and 11. And they are out in this world where they have never seen or heard any of this stuff that's going on around them. So they get first tastes of all kinds of different things, including spells that are, in our world, the analog would be like drugs. that give them all sorts of mystical experiences, as well as, you know, healing spells and curses and all of these sorts of things. So they're getting first tastes of alcohol, first case of love, all of these bursts of fire that are happening around them. So that's book one. Book two deals with interdependence, codependence, that's what I'm trying to say, codependence and enabling. Book three deals with the social conditions that may underlie why certain groups may become more at risk for addictions than other groups. One of the later books deals with prohibition. You know, there's issues of recovery and relapse. There's, with seven books, you can really dig your teeth into a whole lot of different aspects of the theme.
I should probably say, though, that although those are the themes, it's still a heck of an adventure story.
Yes, that's primary. And that's really important, because nobody wants to read a book that's a downer. Oh, my goodness, addictions, da-da-da-da-da, right? But B, you know, hitting you over the head with, you should do this, or you should do that, or, you know, whatever. So it is the thematic content, but there, it's an epic saga. It is... it's dealing with war and sword and sorcery and magic and, you know, the fantasy.
How detailed is your plot for the entire series? Do you have, like, the future books get sort of a paragraph and you'll figure that out later as you get there? Or is it all figured out to great detail already?
Book two was submitted, so it's completely written. Book three is completely plotted out and I'd say 85 to 90% written. I know it doesn't come out till 2021, but it's really nice to be ahead of the curve. The other thing is by working further into the books down the series, that makes sure that I can have the proper seeds planted in the earlier books. Books three, four, five, and six all have some writing in them. All are relatively plotted out, but in broad strokes, more than a paragraph, but still fairly broad strokes. And book seven is planned, but I know how the series ends. It's definitely ending with book seven, but I haven't done any of the writing on book seven yet.
Well, we're getting close to our time being up. Not that there's exactly a firm deadline on these things. It's not like it's a live radio show.
Yeah.
This is the point where I ask the big philosophical questions, mm-hmm. or question, which is basically, why do you write, first of all, and why do you write science fiction and fantasy, second of all, specifically, and I guess, why do you think any of us write this crazy stuff?
I think that... there is a lot to be said for, you know, my initial idea, the fantasy heist romp, you know, just the fun book. I think there's a lot to be said for that. But I don't think we ever even write a very light book without some of that thematic stuff percolating away underneath. I think it always happens, even if we're not in control of it. But... more important, I think all art is a type of leadership within our culture and within our society. If you look at politics, for instance, political leaders in a democracy need to satisfy the masses or they're not going to get reelected, right? The masses, on the other hand, feel kind of powerless because they'll say, well, the leaders are deciding everything. So I think you've got this kind of loop going back and forth between the electorate and the politicians. But where does change come from? It comes from the discourse. The major discourse will determine what both groups are going to pursue. And it is the artist who can influence the discourse. It is the artist who brings up new ideas, who brings up arguments of ways of thinking, and gets people talking. And I'll give you an example of this. I think that for many, many, many years, okay, I'm in Alberta, all right? Oh my goodness, we love our oil in Alberta. If there's any going to be any kind of a development project, oh yeah, maybe there's some hoops to jump through, but it's going to go through. You know it's going to go through, right? In recent years, the assurance of that has been wavering. It's not necessarily for sure anymore that these big mega dams are going to go through. And it's because the discourse is changing. It's because other voices are coming forward and saying, hey, you know, we need to pay attention to climate change. We need to pay attention to the farmland that's going to be flooded by that dam. And those voices are coming forward, and now the major discourse is starting to shift. So our voice is coming forward, and I think artists are a key component of that.
Well, I guess that kind of answers the other question I often ask, which is, because this program is called The World Shapers, if you think, I mean, shaping the world is perhaps a bit grand, but if you are at least shaping the way that individuals think about things in your writing, and is that something you hope you're accomplishing? Do you hope that you're having some impact on the way individuals think about the world and everything? Life,
yes.
The universe and everything.
Life, the universe and everything. Yes, absolutely. I think that that is the purpose and function of art, and as writers we are artists, and I think it's important to be aware of and in control as much as we can of the thematic elements that we're putting forward. But at the same time, story is primary. I mean, you may have ideas that you need, that you want to bring forward, but that is always the underlayer. That is always something that just percolates up. It's story that has to be first and foremost.
And you'd said something about that, things percolating up, whether you know they're there or not. And there is a story, I've told it before, but I always like to, that Isaac Asimov put in his Opus 100, I think, one of his autobiographical books, and how he had gone to a university class in science fiction at some university. It would have been in New York, since he barely traveled. And he heard the professor talking about his story, Nightfall, and he sat at the back and he listened to him going on about it. And then at the end, he went up to the professor and he said, that was a very interesting class, but, you know, I'm Isaac Asimov and I wrote that story and I didn't put any of that stuff in there. And the professor said, well, I'm very glad to meet you, but just because you wrote the story, what makes you think you know what's in it?
You know what? I had heard that story, but I did not realize it was Isaac Asimov's Nightfall.
Yeah, it was definitely Nightfall, and I think it's in Opus 100. So.
Yeah. Oh, I learned something new. That's cool.
So what are you working on next? I think I know the answer to that. It's probably the next book in this series, but are there other things as well?
Yes, absolutely. Actually, I'm really excited about a book project that I've got on the go. One reason I'm kind of glad to be already at book three in this series is because I think over the winter, if there's not too many edits, I've got still a year and a half before it's due, I'm working on one that is a World War II fantasy, and it's kind of a mystery thriller as well. The magical element is a character who can step outside of his body for brief periods to see and hear things without being seen and heard. So he would make a great spy, right? Except that he's had some bad experiences and he is in hiding. He's living on a small farm in rural Alberta, and I'm doing tons of research on rural Alberta in the 1940s. Is really interesting. The book is actually from his wife's point of view, and he gets kidnapped and she does not know where he's gone. So it is her journey to find and rescue her husband. It does take her over to Europe, but also to find and learn about magic. And it also deals with disabilities and mental illness. Now, I don't have a publisher for this book. It's not even written, but I'm really excited about working on it.
Are you still writing short fiction?
You know what? I wish I was. I have like one short fiction story that that is out circulating right now, and I really sure should be doing more short fiction. But yeah, no, I'm just so busy with so many other things, I have not been getting to it this year. Maybe it'll come up in the winter. Maybe I'll get something done this winter.
And you're still doing freelance editing as well?
Yes. Yep. All of the above. And teaching at the Alexandra Writers Center.
So one or two things going on.
Yeah. Keeps me busy.
So where can people find you online?
Well, my website is called speculative-fiction.ca.
Yeah. And how'd you get that?
Oh, yeah. I was very lucky. and then, let's see. I'm on Instagram, Susan Forrest Writes. I'm on Twitter, Susan J. Forrest, and Facebook, Susan Forrest. And, oh, can I just mention, we just put out a wonderful video to support the first book, Bursts of Fire, and it's on YouTube. Just look up Susan Forrest. You'll find me there.
All right. Good stuff. And So thanks so much for being a guest on The World Shapers. I enjoyed it. I hope you did, too.
Thank you.
And I'm sure I'll see you in... probably in Calgary at When Words Collide next year.
Yeah, and I'm going to see you in Ottawa this fall, too.
Oh, you're going to be at CanCon and for the Auroras.
Yep, we'll see you there.
Because, of course, this podcast is also nominated for Aurora this year. So
yeah, good luck.
Yeah, looking forward to that. And my editor, Sheila Gilbert from Daw Books, will be there again this year. So that'll be great as well. All right, so I'll let you go now, but thanks again for being a guest.
Thank you.
And thanks again to Susan for being a guest on the podcast. I had a great time with that conversation, and I hope she did as well, and I hope you enjoyed listening to it. There are many more great guests to come. We have James Allen Gardner, Garth Nix, Rebecca Roanhorse, Mary Robinette Cole, just many, many wonderful guests that I'm working on lining up or have already lined up that you will want to come back and listen to and hear what they have to say about the creation of their wonderful books and characters and worlds. You can find The World Shapers online at theworldshapers.com. You can find it on Twitter at The World Shapers. You can find it on Facebook at The World Shapers Podcast. And you can find me online at edwardwillett.com, edwardwillett.com, two T's. You can find me on Twitter at ewillett. You can find me on Facebook at edward.willett. And if you would like to buy my books and have them autographed and have me send them to you directly, you can do that at edwardwillettshop.com. I think that brings us to the end of this episode. Again, this podcast is a part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network, and the Saskatchewan Podcast Network is supported by Kinexus Credit Union. Thanks again for listening in, and I hope you will come back many more times in the future. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, but it's the first time you've listened to an episode of The World Shapers, do go to the main website, theworldshapers.com, and check out some of the great interviews that have already taken place, as well as coming back in the future to hear all the great interviews that will be taking place. That's it for this time. Bye for now.